Well, good morning to everyone. Welcome to Zen Center. For those of you who are new, we have kind of a smaller group today, which is kind of nice, isn't it? Like the holiday season and the snow. Thank you, Leo, for your offering this morning. Silence seems deeper and more complete to me after a shakuhachi flute. So this morning, I'm going to talk to you about a passage from Dogen Zenji's Genjo Koan. Genjo Koan is usually translated something like realizing the fundamental point, or actualizing the fundamental point. This is a short, relatively short section of something called Shobo Genzo, which is sort of his masterwork. Dogen, for those of you who are new, Dogen Zenji is the founder of Soto Zen in Japan. That's our lineage, our school of Zen in Japan. He lived from 1200 to 1253. So this is, I guess, through one lens, very old material, but through another lens, it's very, very fresh. So it's something we refer to a lot here at Zen Center. Dogen, the works of Dogen. And I want to talk about this morning because the Genjo Koan, when it's printed out in English, it's usually four pages or something like that. And it's one of the things that I chanted to myself recently on a 30-day, I did a 30-day solo retreat. And I did some chanting as part of my daily practice. And the Genjo Koan was something that I chanted aloud to try to kind of understand it in a different way. And other people who have sat here have said this, but as kind of an aside, I highly recommend the practice of chanting. If you have a passage that is particularly interesting to you, inspirational to you, or challenging, puzzling to you, regardless of what it is, something from a book, something from scripture, I don't know what, saying it aloud, chanting it aloud, I think helps you to understand it in a different way. It's certainly a great aid to memorization. Buddhist scripture was traditionally chanted, of course. You'd memorize it by just saying it over and over. So it has a repetitive kind of quality, oftentimes. But there's something about, I think, having it come out of your lips, something about embodying it, like physically having it come out of you, I think changes your relationship with chanting. A lot of people, I think, who have done chanting understand things in a different way. We kind of store them in our body that way. So I recommend that, if that appeals to you. But as I chanted this piece during the course of my month, this one section really stood out for me. And Dogen, at least for me, is kind of famously cryptic and hard to access. I don't think too many people would argue with me on that front. He's sort of hard to get to sometimes. But when we spend a lot of time with stuff like that, especially in the spirit of repetition, reading it over and over, chanting it over and over, some little thing will sort of jump out at you. It's kind of spontaneous Lectio Divina is kind of what it is. And this little section jumped out at me. And it really helped me to see a little bit about how I usually see time and how I see progress and even potential. So I thought I would just share this morning with you what I understood. So the section I'll be talking about is, I know, familiar to some of you and obviously brand new to others, but it reads as follows. Some of it is on your program. Firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Yet do not suppose that the ash is after and the firewood before. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes before and after, and is independent of before and after. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes before and after. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. This being so, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in the Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete this moment. Death is an expression complete this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. So I'm just going to work my way through that. There's a lot there, don't you think? Does it make any sense? If so, we can switch seats. So there is a lot there, but I'll talk about, we'll start with just the first two lines. Firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. That makes sense to us. We get that. That's a linear progression. Got it. Yet, do not suppose that ash is after and firewood before. So that's a little more challenging. I normally do think of firewood as before and ash as after. So that line, I thought, well, he's wrong. So, okay, so there's probably a reasonable chance he's not wrong. Perhaps if I sit with this for several more weeks, it will start to open up. So, one of the things, this is a little bit of a gear shift, but this made sense to me. In classical Chinese, because I was studying some kanji characters, and in classical Chinese, the kanji, the character for butterfly, includes the character for bug. This, so for those of you at home, I am sorry, because I'm using a visual aid, and it's pretty. This is the character for butterfly, right? Pretty cool. This is bug, right? Essentially the first kind of half of it is bug. That's bug, and the whole thing is butterfly. And actually Chinese is really complicated, so there are several different characters for butterfly, and I'm not even going down that road. But what I realized was this character is unique from bug, and it includes bug, because they wanted to denote this particular bug's unique potential, right? So this would apply to any garden variety. It could be any worm, bug, any little small crawling thing, right? This is like, well, it's a small crawling thing, but it's unique. This one becomes something else. This one can become a butterfly, right? If it goes into its cocoon and spends its time there, it comes out as something completely different. So I started thinking, oh, I get it. Caterpillars before, butterflies after. So that was in my mind because I was studying these characters, and then I read this passage from Dogen and went, he's pointing out a flaw in my reasoning, right? Caterpillar isn't pre-butterfly. It's just caterpillar, right? It's 100% caterpillar. It isn't, right? It's not defined by its potential or something that may happen to it later. It's just fully expressing everything that it is right now, right? So focusing, I realized in my way of looking at this, that focusing on the caterpillar's possible future as a butterfly is really like saying the caterpillar is just a means to an end, right? It's a means to an end. And that actually diminishes both the caterpillar and the butterfly both, right? And so I thought, well, when I was a kid, was I just a pre-grown-up? Oh, look at the cute little pre-grown-up. Right? Like somehow childhood is incomplete. It's just a work in progress, and someday it'll be roughed into shape. You know, isn't that nice? That it's defined by what it may someday be, right? By its potential. And yet I realized how often we actually do that. Right? When I was in elementary school, it was like, I'm someday going to be a big kid. I'm going to be in junior high. They're really big kids. They got the cool jackets and the matching patches, and some of them even have beards. then I will have arrived, right? I will have arrived at my potential. And then, of course, when I got to junior high, when I get to be high school, that's when I really, because they can drive cars, there's girls, you know. And, of course, when we get to high school, when I'm in, you know, so this is what we do, right? When I, right? Always defining, in a sense, or limiting the expression of who we actually are by some imaginary future, some idea of potential, what we might become when everything lands, finally, right? So that became really obvious to me, like, oh, I'm kind of perpetually imagining that someday I may become this lovely butterfly, which diminishes, which I think diminishes what our life is now. So we are not proto-people now, waiting to become some sort of... And, of course, the reason this ties in with the Buddhist path is probably obvious to you. A lot of us do think of spiritual practice or the spiritual path as being linear. We just do. We think there's a beginning, the day I first went to Zen Center. Right? And then there's a path, there's a line, a journey, and it lasts, oh man, hopefully like a week. That'd be nice. And then there's an end, which for most of us, in some sort of whatever our language is around it, it's arriving at what? Peace. Peace of heart, peace of mind, serenity, enlightenment. I don't know, but there's that idea we will arrive. Oh, how nice that will be to arrive. And then we can look back on our journey, how nice it was, you know, the beginning, how good that was, and how long it took, and all of our struggles and travails, and oh, it's so nice to have arrived. What a long week it was. So Dogen describes the Buddha way as a circle. And he is famous for unifying, putting together the idea of practice and enlightenment. I know a lot of you know that. Practice is the caterpillar. It's a means to an end. It's slogging through, putting in your time, but it'll be worth it because there's going to be this thing, this payoff, this arrival called enlightenment. There's your butterfly, right? And he's famous for actually invented a character. He squashed practice and enlightenment together to create practice enlightenment. Practice enlightenment. That's what we do. He completely destroyed this idea that there's a line and that there's a means to an end and that there's a goal, essentially, right? By putting it in a circle, well, geez, you can feel the difference. What if the path you're on is a circle? Well, every step you take is the first step. Every step you take is arriving. There's no, right? I mean, you're there. There it is. Ted gave a wonderful talk on the circle of the way a couple months ago, right? A few months ago?
Yeah.
And how lovely that is. How lovely. And yet it also, you know, a lot of us who are very, like myself, who are really critically minded, discursively minded, goal-oriented, I want to do it right. That's frustrating, to be told you can't fail at something. Or to be told, oh, you're there. What? No. It's frustrating, don't you think? There's almost a quality of, well, I'm pretty sure I'm not. I'm still kind of sad and grouchy, and when the traffic's bad, come on, this can't be that thing that I've got in my mind as enlightenment. I really want this thing. So in Shobo Genzo, Dogen says, on the great road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. So that's a very famous section. Aspiration, practice, enlightenment, nirvana. There's your line, right? I had the aspiration, then I went to Zen Center, then I started sitting, and I sat every day, and I did a bunch of retreats, and after a while, nirvana. There's a nice line there. So, by him connecting the end of that line called nirvana to the very beginning of that line called practice, it changes our understanding of what practice is, right? So, every step is arriving home. Complete. So our passage about firewood. Dogen is kind of collapsing our usual idea of time with the idea that firewood in the present is no longer in relation to ash in the future, that there is really no time, and that the caterpillar is not pre-butterfly any more than firewood is pre-ash. He says, you should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes before and after, and is independent of before and after. It's both. That's tough for us, I think. It's tough for me, anyway. It's almost like saying both views are true. You know? Yeah, firewood includes before and after. It includes when it was a tree, when it was a seed. It includes ash and someday compost or mulch. That it includes all those things, and yet it's completely free of both those things, right? So he wrote a little essay for Tricycle Magazine. Kaz Tanahashi, some of you I know that name. He's a famous Zen practitioner, but he's a calligrapher. Is his kind of his claim to fame? He's a master calligrapher. He says the primary concern of the Zen practitioner has been described as the experience of the pure wisdom that sees reality as empty and serene. Empty and serene is how he describes reality. And the primary concern of the Zen practitioner is to practice reality as empty and serene. So there is no before and after in emptiness. And there is no before or after in serenity either. So that sounds abstract, but I actually put it to you that it's not. Because everybody in this place today has had an experience of being deeply serene. I mean, everybody, whether you've ever practiced meditation or not, has had at least a handful of moments in your life where you were deeply content, right? Fabulously content for even only 3 minutes or something. You've had a moment where, right? I'm right? I hope I haven't found, like, the 30 unique people on the planet who have never, ever experienced. Okay, good. So, everybody has experienced, at least for a moment, serenity, that sense of complete contentment. And if you are experiencing deep contentment, it is precisely because you aren't comparing the current experience to before and after. You're just nodding your head going, this is way better than that moment when I was. This moment's pretty good, but it'd even be better if I... That's the whole point. That's exactly why you're experiencing your life as content, because you're not comparing. It is self-fulfilling. There is nothing with which to compare. Right? Does that make sense? I mean, you're completely in that moment. As soon as you step outside of that moment and start comparing, well, there. Now you're not there anymore. Right? Strangely enough, even if it's stepping outside of the moment to really appreciate or grab the moment, you know, wow, this is really a great moment. God, I hope this never ends. Whoops. There I go. I've stepped outside my experience. I'm evaluating. I'm just evaluating how nice it is. Nice is good, but it's still an evaluation, right? So there's something about the quality of mind and heart, because I think it's both. The quality of our heart-mind, when we are deeply serene or deeply contented, that immediately we naturally stop any kind of comparison, because it's just acceptance, complete acceptance, and appreciation of the moment as it is. So when he says that the experience of pure wisdom is seeing reality as empty and serene, I get that, right? And I think everybody does. That is part of the quality of mind that we cultivate on the cushion. So there is a Mahayana Buddhist sutra and school called Tathagatagarbha, which is about the potential. Well, see, that's the word I'm trying not to use so carefully today. because they do say potentiality, they say seed, they say essence, Buddha nature, the seed of Buddhism that is in everything. It's a school of Buddhism that says the nature of everything is to be awake. And so it has oftentimes been described and understood as all of you have this little seed of Buddha inside of you, and all you've got to do is water it correctly and cultivate it correctly, and you will right become that. So it's a beautiful teaching, actually. I love it because it does sort of thwart our tendency to think enlightenment is for somebody else or for somebody special or for, I don't know what, some guy 2,500 years ago, or for maybe just people who are ordained, or maybe just people who are less crazy than I am, right? It's a way of just saying it's the nature of reality, actually. The fabric of reality itself is to awaken. So it's a beautiful teaching. But one of the ways we sometimes misunderstand that is by seeing that, oh, it's a seed that will someday da-da-da, right? So it's kind of like being told, you're a caterpillar, which is really wonderful and special because someday you'll be this amazing thing, right? And so you can see how that's kind of nice, but at the same time, you kind of see what happens in your mind, like someday you will be, sort of makes right now kind of not so great, right? Does that make sense? Like you will someday be, which implies you're not now. Oh, that's sort of a bummer. I mean, we're right back into that linear model again of, you know, well, I'm glad that I'm included, but, you know, that someday I will be, you know, certainly implies that I'm not right now. So Tathagatagarbha, or Buddha essence, Buddha nature, is free right now. Free right now. That's the way... I'm calling out Ted today. I've told you this before. That's the way Ted described Buddha nature in the Rohatsu retreat like 3 years ago. He said, oh, it's not something that happens to you later. It's right now, free right now. Oh, I love it. There's the caterpillar. 100% caterpillar, right? Not diminished by comparing. Not something that's waiting to become. Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha, who you really are, fully expressing right now. Fully expressing right now. And we hear this a lot. We hear this a lot in Zen. We know that some schools of meditation, some schools of Zen have more of a stepladder, is the term we oftentimes use, stepladder Zen. You start here, and then you get to this, and you have this sort of experience, which is cool, and you have an even da-da-da, and then you da-da-da, right? Which is cool. We don't take away the stepladder. There's a usefulness to that. That's fine, right? We're not taking away the caterpillar's potential. It will maybe someday be that, yes. At the same time, our school of Zen, Soto Zen, is sort of, I would say, almost defined by its, I won't say complete rejection of stepladder, but gee, we don't spend much time with that. It really is the Dogen idea of practice and enlightenment, one thing. Not practice as a means, enlightenment as an end. Practice and enlightenment, one thing. And maybe that's just stressed so much and said so often because it's so hard for us to get. It's so hard for us to get. So the idea of Buddhahood or enlightenment being a potential in all of us necessitates, number one, the construct of time. Right? I mean, time would have to be real in order for that to be something that would happen to you at a later time. So it necessitates time. It certainly necessitates the idea of improvement. Well, you could use improvement. That's nice. And, of course, the shadow of that is you are not there now. Isn't that nice that you need improvement? And you know, Zen acknowledges, yeah, these things are true. That's true. That is your potential. And, yes, you could use improvement for sure. But at the same time, we recognize that's only partially true. That's a relative truth. And it's important when we have a stepladder idea about the progress we make on spiritual path, when we have a linear idea, that's fine. But please try to remember that that's really not true. It's just a convenient way your mind organizes things, right? It isn't actual reality. It's just a convenient shorthand. It's like owning things. Like, well, these are my pants. Okay. We'll say that's conventional reality. It helps me put on the right pants in the morning. These are my pants. But do you know what I mean? They're not mine. Whose pants are they going to be in 100 years? I'm not around very long. I'm just impermanent. And pants are impermanent. So conventionally speaking, sure, they're my pants. Right? But we understand that's just shorthand. It isn't actual reality. These are appearing and disappearing, and I'm appearing and disappearing. So, yeah, it's like arguing over whose cloud that is. I don't know. Okay, it's mine. Sure, it's yours. Good luck. So it's one of those ideas. It's useful. Tim would call... Tim calls this, he has this great term for the self, because we spend a lot of time, you know, kind of deconstructing the self in Buddhism. He says, yes, it's a, what does he say? Necessary and useful fiction. Yeah. It's a necessary, I mean, yeah, it's good for me to think that there's a me. That helps me. That's good, good. And at the same time, don't grab onto it. Don't marry it. Don't believe in it. Don't believe in it. Right? That's like ownership. That's like this idea of improvement. Yeah, sure. Sure, I'm working toward that goal. Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. But we can feel the constriction around our hearts when we start to believe in that. Does that make sense? Right? It's always both. Suzuki Roshi said, you're all perfect exactly as you are, and you could all use some improvement. It really is. Of course you could use some improvement. It is your job as a caterpillar to eat lots of leaves and sow that cocoon and spend your time in there and emerge. That's your job. That's what you do. Cool. And at the same time, it's not like you're incomplete now, or less, or broken, or coming up short or something because you're a caterpillar. You're perfect right now. You're a caterpillar. What's wrong with that? Right? So it's both. It's always both. It's always both. So, just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. This being so, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no death. So we had a study group here a few months back that Rosemary and Susan led on Norman Fisher's book, Training in Compassion, which I recommend. It's a beautiful book. He says in there, they're talking about death in this passage, it is artificial to separate life from death. In the very concrete and down-to-earth sense, there is no such thing as life or death. In Zen practice, we speak of birth and death as being one phenomenon, and of course it is. Time passing is birth and death. Moments arise and then pass away. This is one action, one moment. Loss is constant and conditions our every thought, word, and deed. So when I train caregivers for the dying in spiritual hospice care, I always tell them that the work they do isn't about death, it's about life. You are alive as long as you are alive. And when you are not, you are not. So it is a mistake to think of a hospice patient as dying. The patient is alive as long as she is alive. Truly, she is no more dying than we are, for we are dying. That's what living is. Dying a little, moment after moment. Isn't that nice? That's interesting. The person in hospice isn't dying any more than you are. And I'm like, yeah, of course, that's right. That's right. Birth, Dogen says, birth is an expression complete this moment. Complete. Right? Living. That's all you're doing. Just living. You can't say the person in hospice is dying, because no, they're not. They're living. It's a complete expression. It isn't defined by what might happen in the future, right? Death is an expression complete this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. So, as a Minnesotan, I'd like to think of winter as being the beginning of spring. I'm sure that's not what Dogen... I know that's not what he meant. We're not defined by before and after. So there's a saying in Benedictine spirituality, or at least there's a saying I heard a lovely Benedictine nun say once, and she was kind of trying to explain the nature of the absolute through her eyes, you know. The grand creation through her eyes. And what she said is, what happens every spring is just a hint of the thing. That was her answer. And I loved it, because she didn't try to define the grand whatever, but she said, here's a hint, what happens in the spring. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I really like those guys. And so that's true, just as the caterpillar is sort of a hint of butterfly. And at the same time, spring, of course, is just spring. Spring contains all things. It is the whole thing. It is both a hint of the thing, and it's also a full expression of it, right? Because it contains all other things. The spring contains the winter, right? The way the spring contains the summer. The way, like Dogen said, the firewood also includes the tree and the ash, and at the same time is independent from them, right? It's both. He's throwing us outside of the realm of wanting to land at either it's a means to an end or it's not a means to an end. It's both. Causes and conditions are both infinitely connected to every other thing and also completely independent. So Suzuki Roshi again says, he was talking in a Dharma talk about cleaning, the practice of cleaning. It's famous in Zen. After Zazen, you all do cleaning, you sweep. And he was explaining to these newer students, well, we're not sweeping because the Zendo needs sweeping. We're sweeping because it's time to sweep. Which is a little bit weird. We're like, well, what? We clean to clean, not because something is dirty. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? We clean to clean, not because something is dirty. So cleaning is an activity in itself. It's self-fulfilling. It's not a means to an end. This is totally different than our way of thinking about it. Oh, that really needs cleaning because it's a mess. Cleaning, therefore, is a means to the end called clean. I will feel better when it's clean. I will, therefore, engage in cleaning, right? Everything is in relation to everything else, you know. I mean, I know that's how we all do this. This is just how we all view our world. And so when he says, you clean to clean, you just think, what? Yeah, well, no, of course you clean because something's dirty. Why else would you do it? So, Katagiri, talking about this very same idea, says doing zazen, because this is zazen, right? Do you see how, you know, if we're cleaning because it's dirty, we're sitting zazen to get something called enlightenment. Right? It's a means to an end. It's a means to an end. Do you feel how that kind of changes the energy around the activity, sort of cheapens it? I'm going through this to get to the thing. And how often when I've noticed in myself, when I am cleaning, I am constricted, usually in the shoulders and back. My breathing is oftentimes shallow, and I'm thinking about it being clean because I want to get there. And if there was a way I could make that room cleaner like that, I'd do it. I'm not valuing the experience of holding a broom and sweeping. It just isn't valuable to me. It's beneath me. This moment isn't good enough. I want to arrive at the moment where the room is clean. Ah. And so sweeping is the price I have to pay to get to the moment where the room is clean. Right? I'm in transaction with my experience. This moment is not so great. I'll do my best. I'm a good Zen student. But I really want to arrive. Oh, won't that be nice, right? And how often we do that with our spiritual practice. It's a means to an end. So even if this was your first time in this room today, at the end of Zazen, when Dave rang the bell, how many of you went, that was pretty good. I feel a little bit stiller. I'm a little more, yeah. I mean, how could I have maybe better spent 40 minutes? 40 minutes is a long time. I am 23% stiller than I was before he started that. I would say that's time well spent. And I will agree to continue doing that as long as I continue to feel 23% stiller. But as soon as the bell rings and I don't feel any better, I am out of here, right? Because I'm evaluating my experience and I want to get to something, which makes this moment unacceptable and lacking. And we do this to ourselves a lot. So we clean to clean. Katagiri says, doing zazen is dynamic practice. It is the pure functioning of this moment. It is not an idea. Such practice is undefiled. Undefiled. So he says undefiled, which means here, you know, idea, concept, conceivable, graspable, comparing, using as a means to an end. Which reminds me, he also said, Dogen's teaching is not about belief. It's about understanding what is ungraspable and inconceivable. And I love the word inconceivable because it reminds me of when I was doing Zen initiation here years ago, we were talking about the Bodhisattva vows, which we'll chant today at the end of the talk. And the Bodhisattva vows are essentially making four statements about the nature of reality and then vowing at the end of each one of those statements to do something. And at first glance, you'd think, well, we're just basically promising four times to do something that's impossible. So why would we waste our time? So when we get to them, this maybe will make more sense. But I raised my hand and said, how come we're vowing to do something that's impossible? And Tim said, they're not impossible, they're just inconceivable. And at first I was like, seriously? What kind of answer is that? I mean, who are you? What is your deal? I just thought that. I didn't say it. But then I spent more time with it, and I went, oh, that's one of those wonderful jujitsu kung fu moves that was so valuable to me, because I realized impossible is like saying it can never happen. Inconceivable just means I don't get it. Right? Does your brain get it? No. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. So he's almost encouraged me, just let go. Vow anyway. It's inconceivable. Yeah, don't worry about it. It's not impossible. So, in his essay, Kesa Kodoku, Dogen was talking about, there's a whole essay about the okesa, the robe, the Buddhist robe. And one of the sentences that he has in that piece, in that fascicle, is the okesa exists beyond our ideas of it. And I went, ooh, that's a cool line. So I was thinking about that. This was years ago when we were sewing, and it finally dawned on me, oh, I get it. Everything exists beyond our ideas of it. He's just saying, don't be caught by your limitations. Don't be caught by your limitations. Your ideas about reality don't touch reality, right? So when we're sewing in Zen practice, sewing is kind of a big deal. And for some folks who choose to go through initiation, or ordination, we spend a lot of time sewing. And when we are sewing, we are told by our wise and compassionate sewing teacher, Rosemary, who's in the room right now, and I'm very aware of that. She tells us, well, you're sewing Buddha's robe. Tomoe-san would say, you are sewing Buddha's robe. So, you know, just sew as such, treat it as such. And so you think, oh, I get it. This robe, you know, is made with the same pattern, you know, as the robe the Buddha likely wore, so it's kind of like his. No, you're sewing Buddha's robe. Please sew it as such. Please treat it as such. So we think, oh, I get it. This robe represents Buddha's robe. It's a symbol of another robe, right? So, no, you are sewing Buddha's robe. Please sew on it and treat it as such. So she's saying exactly what she's saying, right? Zen teachers do that. It's very frustrating. She's not saying you're wearing a symbol or a reminder or a version of. It is the whole thing. It isn't, right? It's not a copy. It's not something pointing at. It is the whole thing. It is the whole thing. That changes our relationship with it, right? It takes away that whole potential part of caterpillar and allows it to just be what it is. So this teaching, of course, applies to everything. It applies to everything. Even our most common things. Katagiri used to always love, in the talks I've listened to, he used to love to use the example of toilet paper. Because it's like the least valuable thing we can universally possibly think of. And he's like, your toilet paper is Buddha, treat it as such. And you're like, what? Yes, it is. Well, think of how that changes your relationship with something. You know, when your car keys, when your shoes, when your toilet paper, when your robe, when your coffee cup later, right? It changes our relationship with experience. So, Katagiri says, when I meet with a student and the student tells me something or asks me a question, often I am expected to make some immediate response. The student tries to get something from me. But this is not real meeting. A real meeting offers no response. It is just this moment arising. If you beat a drum to assert yourself, no matter how long you hit the drum, the universe will not respond to you. Your expectations kill the possibility. But if you practice with no expectation, the universe responds. Therefore, to truly see a teacher or anybody means you cannot expect a certain response. If you have a preconceived idea of your meeting, there is actually no meeting. No response means to just see. Just see, just do. When you meet Zazen, just meet. Well, I can't improve on that. When you meet Zazen, just meet. A student tries to get something from me, but this is not real meeting. A real meeting offers no response. So we can see that in ourselves, right? We can see that in ourselves. I know for one, when I go up and have Dokusan and I have a meeting with Tim or any of our teachers here, oh, definitely I want something. It's their job to give it to me. Yeah, I mean, come on. Fancy pants, give me your mojo. And I have to confess, I have on more than one occasion left Dokusan thinking, well, why didn't he give it? I mean, I know he had it. He just didn't give it to me. Am I not good enough? I got to sit up straighter or something. Right? I'm assuming that what I'm saying on some level makes sense. Yeah, there's just that little. It's a kind of a very childlike place. If I want my, come on, I want my gold star, my sucker, something. Give me a little something. And I understand that expectations kill the possibility. Expectations kill the possibility. That's the other side of the equation, right? The relative side of the equation is, of course, when you meet with the teacher, you should feel seen, you should feel heard, you should feel supported. Good for you. I fully support your going into the Dokusan room under any circumstances, and I also support you going into the Dokusan room and wanting something. Good for you. Keep doing it. I think that's fine. I do. But I also understand that there's a quality of being when people are together and there is no agenda and there is no expectation that allows something bigger to happen, something more authentic to happen, you know. And I think the expectation kills the possibility. I think that's why we have such a hard time seeing the caterpillar if we think it's a pre-butterfly. I just can't see you as whole because I keep thinking what you might be. Right? Or even what you were. A lot of us do the opposite. You know, when Dogen's playing with time here, right? That, you know. So if I'm meeting you and you're my old high school friend and I have just locked in my mind what you were back in 19 whatever and we called you Chopper and you're not Chopper anymore. You haven't been Chopper for 2 decades, but in my head, I can't see you anymore. Because I'm locked into when you were firewood and now you're ash. Right? And same thing. So it's we do this all the time. So I'm getting near the end here. Joan Chittister is one of my favorite people to read online. She's a nun, and she's got such great things to say. She says, years ago, when I was working with new members in the community, there was always one session in which I asked each of them individually and in turn why they went to prayer. She's Catholic. The answers were always full of the piety that comes with newness and the theology that comes from books. We go to prayer because prayer is what leads us to perfection. That's why I go to prayer. And I would shake my head, no, that's not why we go to prayer. They'd think about it a while, and then someone else would try. We go to prayer to immerse ourselves in God. I'd shake my head, nope. We are always immersed in God. That's not why we go to prayer. So then their brows would tighten around the table. I think we go to prayer to remember God, somebody would say a bit more tentatively. I'd shake my head, no. Awareness is certainly a state we seek, but it is not why we go to prayer. By this time, there are fewer quick answers, and finally one of the brave ones would say, well, then why do we go to prayer? I think that's great. I would smile and say, we go to prayer around here because the bell rings. So boy, could that be a Zen story, right? We are sitting Zazen to become a Buddha. Right? And then the teacher famously picks up the tile and starts polishing the tile, going, what are you doing? Oh, I'm making a mirror. How are you going to make a mirror? By polishing a tile. How will you become a Buddha? By sitting Zazen. You see how we short-circuit what actually is by what it might be. Right? So his teacher isn't saying Zazen is useless practice for making a Buddha. Don't do it. There are times I wanted it to mean that, because Zazen is hard sometimes. But no, Buddha right now, free right now, always, right now, you are awake. By seeing what you're doing as a means to an end, something down the line, you're in exchange for something, you're pulling yourself out of the present, you're not here. Right? You're not here all the way. So you sit because the bell rings. That's why you sit. We sit to sit, you would say. So in my retreat, in my long retreat recently, something kind of became clear to me. Very subtle for those of you who have been doing Zazen a while, you realize the mind is kind of like an onion that sort of peels over time, and you have subtle sort of realizations about something. All right. Does that make sense? A lot of you kind of like, oh, I get it. I've been doing that forever. So it was about probably 3 weeks into the retreat. All of a sudden, I just realized I'm trying to get something. It should have been really obvious. I mean, of course I would have known that, but it arose in my consciousness in a different way. I'm trying to get something. This whole endeavor, 21 days of staring at the wall, I've been trying to get something. And it was humbling for me because we talk so much in Soto Zen about, don't try to get anything, just sit. Right? I was like, oh man, I've been doing this for a long time. I'm still right back there again. Well, it was okay. It was okay. But it was important for me to see it over and over. I'm always trying to get something out of the retreat, right? Out of the Zazen, out of this arduous, difficult experience. I want to have something to take back with me, right? I want to be different when I come home. God, you're so different. Oh, you're so still all the time. You're never arguing. Or I had this great experience and I can present it to my teacher. He'll be really proud of me. There'll be some sort of thing. So... And what I noticed about that moment of wanting something, because my mind was pretty still, what I noticed was there was a felt quality of unease. The wanting has an unease, right? That's dukkha. This is Four Noble Truths stuff, just recognizing our tendency to want reality to be different and the dis-ease that comes with that. The subtle suffering, right? The struggle that comes with that wanting to always wring reality. A little bit. So I kind of smiled at myself and I let it go. But I did notice that my sittings changed after that. And it was a lot more like what Joan Chittister talked about. I sat because it was time on the schedule to sit. That's it. There's no point to sitting other than to sit. So I just sat. And it changed, right? My experience with those things. And eating becomes just eating, not something you do to get full, right? And walking became just walking and not something you do to get your exercise, right? There isn't a transaction. Because you realize like every single thing we do could be seen as a means to an end. You never arrive. You're never there, ever. Even right now, you're listening to a Dharma talk because, I don't know, I hope you're not trying to get something out of this. But, you know, right? And then later you drive because you drive as a means to get home. And then when you're home, you know, as a means to have a certain experience, feel a certain way, right? I mean, we're constantly doing that. So I really touched that. I really felt that. Oh, all of it is about trying to get something. So what happened to me after 3 weeks is something all of us do all the time on the cushion. This is just your Zazen, you guys. You can do it in any given moment. Just recognize, oh, there's that wanting. There's that tightening that we do with our heart, our mind, around something. Grabbing. And just recognize, oh, that's me. And open it. Gently, that's all. And it'll close again after a few seconds. That's okay. It will. Open it again. All right, open it again. That's really all we're doing is just recognizing this moment is full and complete and whole and fine right now just as it is. And within that whole fine, complete moment, I can plan for the future. I can work to improve myself. Right? I can engage in activities. I call like all that stuff. But always remembering that fundamentally reality is whole, undivided, perfect, arising. There's no problem. There's no problem. There's no boundary. Right? Just opening over and over to that. And that might have an experience quality to it or it might not, but that's really all we do. And we're just retraining our hearts. We're retraining our minds to be satisfied more, want less. That's really all it is. Want less. Recognize when it's happening. Retrain it. Wanting less, being satisfied more. So, I'll wrap up and... I just want to remind you, I guess, the point of this whole endeavor with Dogen and Firewood is to remind you that although everybody has the potential to become butterflies, that what you are right now is whole, and caterpillar is fine, and please see caterpillar, right? Please don't overlook caterpillar in your life because of what it was, because of what it might be. Your life is beyond all your ideas about it. Good, bad, or indifferent is beyond all of those things. It is not something waiting to happen. It is not an improvement on what was. It is not a quasi-proto version. It's not any of those things. Right? All your ideas about your life are hopelessly inadequate for describing what your life actually is. Right? It's it's just like Rosemary says, it's Buddha's robe, just treat it as such, see it and treat it as such. That's it. Right? That's really it. So dropping our agenda, appreciating what is there, recognizing, here it is, complete right now. That is our intimacy, that is our freedom. So, that is my talk, too. That is my talk. So I thank you for your attention. This is not the post-comments as opposed to, right, the pre was the talk, and then now this is the post. And we got announcements. Oh, I went long. Maybe a question or two really quick if there were something. If there's, yeah, just in case there's something. Yes.
Hi, thank you for your talk, Martin. And I think it's very timely, considering the time of year where it's cold and we build fires and we also live in a state with a lot of Scandinavian people. Some of you may or may not know that the number one most popular show in the country of Norway is an 8-hour-long show of a fireplace burning fire. And the country is transfixed by watching that fire burn. And there's also a book in Norway about how you should stack wood. Should the bark be up or the bark be down?
Oh, wow.
So in the country of Norway, wood and fire burning are huge. And when I read this, I thought, well, that's ridiculous. But now I understand the meaning. So thank you.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it. Yeah. You know, I've seen those DVDs. You can buy a DVD of the fireplace, and I've always been sort of like, is that the most depressing thing in the world, or is that really cool? Because I bought one once for $1. It was in a dollar bin, and I bought it. But it's kind of just it's so quirky and sort of twisted. And then I put it on and just saw myself going, yeah, like this is the best dollar I ever spent. This show works all the time. I'm with you. I totally get why that would be. Especially there in Norway. Oh, my God, yeah, yeah.
WCCO projects a burning fireplace.
Right, on Nicollet Mall.
Happening right now.
That's right, they do. That would make a terrible book. When you were saying that was the most popular like TV show, then when you went to say book, I was like, yeah, how would that be a book?
About firewood.
Yeah, yeah. I just... If anybody can write a good burning fire book, crackle, crackle, crackle. Crackle, crackle.
Pop, pop.
Pop, pop. Ooh, I like the pop part.
Yeah.
Anything else this morning? Eric.
Yeah, there was quite a bit on there. But as you were talking, I was picturing this real, like an ancient seeker going to an ancient yoga master and saying, you know, seeing that and going, I want what you have. And the master saying, all right, you have it already. There you go. And the seeker says, you know, but you have gone through decades of training and stuff. And the master says, yes, and you have it. And it's my pleasure to share that with you. And the seeker, like so many of us still nowadays, says, you don't understand. I am a really, really terrible person, and you can't just give this to me. I need to suffer for it. And so the master says, okay, you can suffer for it. You're going to do that anyway. I think the fundamental difference is while the master does all this for fun, the student emulates that and does it for pain. And so he sees, like, okay, we're going to sit and we're going to face the wall and grit my teeth. And also this idea of a linear progression kind of as a means to an end predates the English language. Mm-hmm. But in our language, we have a very clear difference between practicing and doing.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
When they're not, we say... like practicing the piano is playing the piano, no matter what you're doing. but I think we even take it farther that we associate doing something with actually not doing it, because we say, "I will be able to play the piano when I am done playing the piano." We have the same thing. Like I hear a lot of like professors and authors saying, "I don't like writing. I like having written." In which case, you would call yourself a rotor. Yeah, and so I think I like Dogen's said, like bunker fly or whatever. I think he couldn't possibly have foreseen our culture and stuff, but he recognized like a lot of his more comprehensible stuff recognizes this super common thread throughout humanity that will just always remain relevant, which is it's great. Oh, and the cleaning thing. I love that idea of cleaning just for cleaning, because to realize cleaning something because it's dirty is really frustrating. But sweeping just to sweep, then it's never dirty, and I thought that was a really good personification of effortless effort. So I'll stop there. Thanks for...
Oh, thank you. No, that's great. I especially love the... I'm practicing the piano. I was like, well, but you're playing it. Because you're realizing that the split we create between this... So Zen practice...